Thou shalt have no other gods before me. I am your God, you are my people. And all of the rest of the commandments, not only the nine commandments that we usually traditionally have, but I think the rabbis counted 613 of them in the Torah, in the Pentateuch. 365 of them were positive and the rest were negative, one for each day of the year. Those where there was actually expression of the will of God. But I think you should refine that. They are not just new commandments or anything. They are, what shall we say, ramifications of the fundamental stipulation. Therefore, when you take someone's land, the way the king did in the section we had last time, took a neighbor's ancestral land that had been given to him by the Lord, you are not just doing a naughty little thing, but you are breaking the whole covenant. That's the whole point. And I think that this became a crisis thing when Israel had kings. They thought the kings would bail them out in their crisis with the Philistines. The Philistines were overpowering. They said, we've got to have a permanent army. We can't just wait for an old-fashioned militia to come together in a holy war and fight it out when some prophet announces an emergency. We've got to have a king who will go out in front of us and come in before us so that we will be like the rest of the nations, can stand up to them. That meant, of course, a very dangerous thing, because all of kingship in that world was sacred kingship. And that meant that they could easily put in the place of their real king, the Lord, they could put this human king who would mislead them into idolatry. And there were plenty of people who didn't like Samuel's compromise right from the word go and said it was a mistake to have kings and never should have gone in on it. Samuel tried to put this foreign idea of kingship inside of the covenant and kind of holy waterize it and housebreak it so it didn't mess up the covenant relationship and make it an Israelite kingship. But the kings were often delinquent. Even some of the best of them just never really pulled it off. We'll have tomorrow King Josiah, perhaps one of the best, a reformer. And Jeremiah denounces his reform program. That's very interesting. So what I'm saying is that somehow or other, kingship, not only because it brought Israel to a military power, an imperial power that she conquered everybody else, and they brought in the booty, and Jerusalem became a great city with a big bureaucracy, head of the military thing. They had a Pentagon and so forth. What happens is that they now begin to, as often happens in prosperity, throw their weight around. And as Amos says, they expect the millennium is here. The day of the Lord is here. Amos says, he's kind of rough. He says, that day is not going to be a light for you. It's going to be no millennium. It's going to be darkness. And that'll be a day of judgment instead of a day of victory, the way they expected. And so the prophets, we saw that with Elijah, they are emergency measures. You see, the ongoing way of instructing people in what the just relationship in society should have been would have been their natural leaders, not only the elders who would teach the people inside of their tribes and clans and families, but the priests. They had them. And there were, in connection with the priests, also culty prophets there. But here you've got a livestock breeder, a cowboy, if you will, Amos, who says, as we'll see in this section, I'm not a prophet. Nor am I a disciple of the prophet, a son of the prophet. But the Lord called me. And he stands up against, in this case, both the king and the priest, Jeroboam, and the priest Amaziah, in order to proclaim the word of the Lord. And that's what a prophet really is. He's not just a kind of a soothsayer or a magic man that kind of manipulates the deity or someone that can see into the future. He will talk about the future, but what he really is a messenger. And that's why he uses the messenger formula, thus saith the Lord. Now the classic example of the prophet simply being accused of being a revolutionist was the this example that we had here in this text, Amos 7, 10 to 17. It's a very interesting story, so we'll just go through that rather carefully as we usually do here. It's perhaps a few words in introduction to it. It's perhaps the last episode in his activity, and it took place at Bethel. Now, Bethel had been an ancient shrine. You remember the patriarch Jacob slept there and saw that ramp leading up to heaven, and God gave him promises. And but now it was a state sanctuary. Can anyone tell me how come this got to be a state sanctuary? In other words, a church built by the king, with its clergy responsible to the king in Samaria. How come Bethel was just not another, they had other sanctuaries in various places. How come Bethel was a place, it's very important for the story, that was underneath the auspices of the king? Anyone know that? Well, Jerusalem down south had been built up by Solomon when the empire was still together. And well, David started it, and then Solomon built the temple. And everybody went down there. But as soon as they had the secession of the north, you remember the northern tribes broke off, they didn't want the people from the north to continue going down to the south, because they thought, well, then they'll politically get underneath the house of David, and we'll lose those people. So they literally built, like they did in East Berlin, a wall. And archaeologically, you will find along the border between Judah and Israel large cities. They're nothing but villages, large fortresses. They're nothing but villages, but they're built up as fortresses. And it was a kind of a iron curtain, you see. And there was border warfare there for the whole first section. And then the first king of the north, the secessionist, whose name was Jeroboam the First, he simply established way up in the north at Dan a place to worship, a state sanctuary, and then on the south border, very close to the border. And he said, why must you people go all down to Jerusalem? It's just, you can worship the Lord here as well as in Jerusalem, you see. Later on, the Deuteronomist reformers, they said, that's where they first went off the deep end. They'd have stayed with the worship in Jerusalem, the one altar and the one priesthood. Everything had been okay. That was the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, wherewith he made Israel to sin. It's mentioned each time why they went off the deep end. So now notice that at Bethel here, which is about 35 miles south of their capital city, Samaria. See, the northern capital was Samaria, see. Southern capital was Jerusalem. And southern kingdom is Judah, with a line of David in it. The northern kingdom had 13 dynasties. And that's important, especially with this conspiracy. Because, all you had to do in the north is suffer a military defeat, and then it was a whole bunch of tribes. The down south, it was only one tribe, and they were all well integrated. They had a natural fortress there in Judah. Jerusalem was a nice place, whereas Israel is a conglomeration of all kinds of tribes. Some of them living in the mountains, and some down in the valleys, and some speaking, having these customs, and it was not a natural geographical unit. And you had to have some real power there to pull it together. In fact, Samaria was its third capital city. That shows the instability of it. The first time, well, they crowned their first king Jeroboam in Shechem. That was the center of the land. Then they moved it up to Tirzah, but then they had some wars and burning, and then they had finally moved it to Samaria, which was a good spot. And this was where the capital city was. But now notice that this guy Amos, though he comes from the deep south, from Birmingham, Selma, he is not preaching at this time down south in Judah, if he ever did. He is preaching up in the north. And he had been up to the capital city in Samaria. And now, in this last episode, he is at the state sanctuary at Bethel. That's rather important. Now, apparently, the priest that's involved here, his name is Amaziah, was in charge of that state sanctuary. At least he had to supervise it. And we know, since it was a very touch-and-go political situation, that all you'd have to do is to have a circle of prophets make a conspiracy, and then you could bring down the government. In fact, that dynasty of which Jeroboam is a part, the dynasty of Jehu, had come to its power because there was a conspiracy by the Elisha group. And they had anointed Elisha, one of Elisha's disciples had anointed Jehu. We talked about that last time. And he had marched in the capital city and simply taken over. So now, this is kind of touch and go. And Amaziah, who is responsible to the king for what goes on at that sanctuary, reports the activity of this ancient, let's call him Dr. Martin Luther King, this prophet from Tekoa. Tekoa is just a little south of Bethlehem, and down here from Judah. And he's up there north, and he had been around there a number of times, and the people would have liked to have him shut up. But he was always like those prophets, unpredictable, and now he was there at the royal sanctuary. So what does the king do? Do you have a Bible there? Let's see. Oh, Bob, would you read there? I think we'll just take two verses there. 10 and 11.
The name of Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, sent to Jeroboam, the king of Israel, saying, Amos has conspired against you in the midst of the house of Israel. The land is not able to bear his words, for thus Amos has said, Jeroboam shall die by the sword, and Israel must go into exile away from his land.
Yeah, so he's a dutiful priest. He's in charge, and this can get into something trouble. He calls it conspiracy, doesn't he? He's conspired. There's conspiracy. And how would you get a message up there? He says he sent. There are two ways of doing it. How did you send messages in those days?
Messenger.
A messenger, a herald. And since it's about 35 miles, how long would that take you?
2 days, 1 day.
Less than a day, I think, because a messenger from the king, the royal king, would have to run. I don't know if it's a marathon, but he'd have to go. I don't know if they had relays or something, but this is there's not a lot of time here. This is rather important for the story. He's sent that message up there. Now, what the king will do, and I don't think he'll like this very much, what Amos is doing, you see. And he says, Jeroboam's going to die by the sword. Israel's going to be taken to Siberia, to exile. And the Assyrians are going to take over. Nobody likes to hear that. And so he says, this is dangerous. In fact, what does he say? The land is not able to bear all his words. Not able to really, like a barrel fills you've got a barrel with water, you know, and then what finally makes it overflow?
Last drop.
He had plenty of things that he was saying, plenty of oracles, and now this is the final one. And so he has to report it, you see. He is a shrewd politician. If you ever want a shrewd politician, a church politician, or take Amaziah as your model. He knows just how to speak first out of one side of his mouth, and as we'll see next time, out of the other side of his mouth, without involving himself, not even religiously. He's really an interesting guy here. So, let's give an example, and just page through a few of what he had said. Let me give you an example of chapter 4, verse 1 to 3. Some of you have not studied this, but it's kind of interesting. There he takes up the women of Samaria. This he must have, earlier in his prophecy, spoken. He calls them cows. A lady who was beautiful in those days was not slim, as in our Greek idea, but she was fat. I'm quite sure that Queen of Sheba was an old hag. She was fat. You see all the people in the Egyptian scribes and so forth, they had just rolls of fat. That means they're beautiful, you see? And so what does he call these corn-fed Nebraska cows? So he called these ladies, "Hear this word, you cows of Bashan, who are in the mountains of Samaria." It's only little hills, but he calls it mountains. "Who oppress the poor, who crush the needy, who say to their husbands, bring that we may drink, that we may carouse. In other words, climb the social ladder so we get a little more money in. The Lord has sworn by his holiness that, behold, the days are coming upon you when they'll take you away with hooks. And the Assyrians did that. And even the last of you with fish hooks. They put them in your nose, cut off your part of your nose and your ears too. And you will go out through the breaches. The battering rams will knock down the walls, and you'll have to go out there to slavery. Everyone straight before, and you'll be cast forth unto Hermon. Or a better example is the type of life that he is castigating is in chapter 6. Well, I'll look at that for a moment. We'll read a little longer there. Verse 1 and following. Woe to those who are at ease in Zion. All these wealthy people. And this was boom time, by the way. They were laborers were buying silk shirts, and they didn't care whether they had to pay $34 for them, the way it is in America today. And to those who feel secure on the mountains of Samaria, the notable men of the first of the nations, to whom the house of Israel come, pass over to Calneh and see. That's a town that the Assyrians had knocked to pieces. Go thence to Hamath the Great, then go down to Gath of the Philistines. Are they better than these kingdoms? Or is their territory greater than your territory? O you who put far away the evil day and bring near the seat of violence. Woe to those who lie upon beds of ivory. These had been found remnants that the British excavated in Samaria, and they found that there were inlays in beds and a lot of other things in ivory, and very, very sumptuous, who stretch themselves upon their couches, who eat lambs from the flock. They're really gourmets. Calves from the midst of the stall, who sing the idle songs of the sound to the sound of the harp, and like David invent for themselves instruments of music, who drink the wine in bowls and anoint themselves with the finest oils, but are not grieved over the ruin of Joseph. It's all built on injustice of the poor. Therefore, they shall now be the first of those to go into exile, and the revelry of those who stretch themselves shall pass away. And I hope you'll forgive me for taking another one. And this is in chapter 3. It's a favorite of mine. Where he calls, this is in chapter 3, verses 9, 10, and 11. It's just a short one, one of his little oracles. They've all been collected. I think that Amos had a good secretary. And one of these prophets collected all the stuff. And you've got all these doom oracles, chapters 3 to 6, and they're all in nice sections. You pick one after another. Well, here's one where it says, you better send a messenger to Assyria and to Egypt and tell them if they really want to see how to oppress the poor, they better come to Samaria. Proclaim to the strongholds in Assyria and to the strongholds in the land of Egypt and say, assemble yourselves upon the mountains of Samaria. If you really want to see something, kind of like in an arena, watching what you're to see there. See the tumults within her, the oppressions in her midst. They do not know how to do right, says the Lord. Those who store up violence and robbery in their strongholds. So they spend all their money on defense in their strongholds, but it's all based upon their violence and robbery. And he means, of course, this annexation of other people's lands, violating the covenant and the Sabbath rules we talked about. Verse 11 gives the doom then. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, an adversary shall surround the land and bring down your defenses from you, and your stronghold shall be plundered. So that's just a little side remark on what did Amaziah mean by saying the land can't bear all of his words. And as you rightly said, Herb, that this last prophecy of his saying that Jeroboam himself would die by the sword, and that now the time would come, the Assyrians are going to come back and they're going to take him to exile. They'll lose their national existence. The end. Now that's the end. So he has to report it, you see. No doubt about that. Well, let's go a little off. Well, yes, there's one thing yet we should say here. As long as we're looking there in chapter 7, why don't you look in chapter 7, verse 7, 7, 8, and 9. And maybe you could read that for me, Herb, because here's one of the visions that the prophet had when he was called. It also talks about this very same thing.
He showed me, behold, the Lord was standing beside a wall built with a plumb line, with a plumb line in his hand.
What do you do when you stand next to a wall with a plumb line? See how straight the wall is. And if it's not straight, what does the building inspector do?
Down.
Down it goes. Now notice, it doesn't describe the Lord at all. All it describes is the plumb line. That's the covenant and its regulations. And here it is, okay?
And the Lord said to me, Amos, what do you see? And I said, a plumb line. Then the Lord said, behold, I am setting a plumb line in the midst of my people Israel. I will never again pass by them. The high places of Isaac shall be made desolate, and the sanctuaries of Israel shall be laid waste, and I will rise up, I will rise against the house of Jeroboam with the sword.
Yes, that was a prophecy that called for reporting this to the king. All right, now let's just stop here for a moment. The prophet has appeared in Bethel, the state sanctuary, and what he is saying is, it breaks the camel's back, you see. So the priest has to report it to headquarters. Now what's interesting is what he does in the meantime. Now I don't know whether it takes a whole day to get the message up there and for the king to make up his mind. I don't think the king has long to make up his mind. But there'll be an edict coming back that you can expect, and it's not going to be a good one, see. So now what else does he do? Let's go on to the next part. Would you mind reading for us there? Let's see. I think the next verse is there. 12 and 13 in chapter 7 there.
Also Amaziah said unto Amos, O thou seer, go, flee thee away into the land of Judah, and there eat bread, and prophesy there. But prophesy not again any more at Bethel, for it is the king's chapel, and it is the king's court.
Yes, uh-huh. He calls him seer. What do you think that means? He could have called him prophet, but he calls him seer. Well, what's a seer? Yes, or who can see where lost asses are, or things that you don't know. You know that famous story, don't you, that when Saul, a young farmer boy, went out to find his father's lost asses and found a crown?
Mm-hmm.
Don't you remember that they were lost and they didn't have barbed wire fences, and I don't know if they had bronze or anything. He's said to, by the way, a slave, a very interesting thing, to go along with him. And they'd been looking all around and they never found them. And then he said, well, we better go back home because our father will worry more about us than about the lost she-asses. And then, how is it? I think it's... Saul comes next to Raymond. He says, there's a seer in that town. He can see where lost she-asses are. And the slave, I think it's a slave says that, yes. And then he's a young boy, the same age as Saul. And Saul says, yeah, but I don't have any money. That means you had to pay for this. You can't get any religious services without paying on the dotted line. And then the servant says, well, I've got a half a shekel. Usually you carried your money in your wad here in your cud. That's why when you died later in Roman history, you always had to have what? For paying your way across the Styx, you had to have a coin there. Wasn't it a copper coin to get across? And so we don't know just how he carried it, but he says, I've got a half a shekel. Okay, so we can go to him. We'll find out he can see where the lost she-asses are. Now that could be one way. It's a very old word. It's not the word for prophecy. And you were reading King James, and that's right. Seer. It's the same thing here in the RSV. You could also translate a visionary, see that? I think, however, that instead of the way many people interpret this, that Amaziah is having a put-down here, calling him a seer. No, I think that he has to treat this guy with certain respect. You never know what these prophets are doing, what they're saying. And therefore, I think it's a term of respect here. Now, there might be a difference of opinion, and that's not important. But there's, a certain amount of, throughout this, a respect for a charismatic person. A prophet is that. And that's why he commands him to do what? O seer, go and flee. If you want to prophesy, heavens, why don't you prophesy down south? Why must you come here to Chicago? and move into slumlord property and fix it up for the poor. That's breaking the law, don't you know that? And then march in Cicero, of all places. That's when you really want to get into troubles. So what he is saying, you can prophesy, you can go and eat bread. What does he mean? Earn your living, isn't it? If you want to go and earn your living, go down south. Just cross the border, it doesn't take long. And flee, because all hell will break loose if you stay here. You all know that. And prophesy there. But never again, now he warns him, don't you ever again prophesy here at Bethel, because this is the king's sanctuary, it's the temple of the kingdom. So I suppose officially he could have evicted him from the sanctuary. I think so. But he doesn't do that. What he'd like to do is what? Get him out of the realm, see? No blood in his hands, nothing. Nice way to do it. So does he say the same thing to Amos that he said to the king? Am I right when I say that he's talking out of both sides of his mouth? I think so. I think that he's talking in both ways. It's kind of interesting. Does he say anything to Amos about the content of what Amos is saying? No, he says nothing about God. Doesn't want to get in on that. It's very interesting how shrewd he is. These guys may seem to be dumb, but they're very, very clever. And he creates the impression, it may be the right impression, that he really likes this guy. And he doesn't want him to get into trouble. But he says, for sure, and don't come back here and prophesy here. I don't mind you earning a living. You can go and earn a living down there. And you'll get paid all the time. Okay, let's go on to the next part. The verses 14 and 15. Now how does the prophet respond? Would you continue right up the line there? I don't know your name.
Then answered Amos and said to Amaziah, I was no prophet, neither was I a prophet's son, but I was an herdman and a gatherer of sycamore fruit. And the Lord took me as I followed the flock, and the Lord said unto me, go prophesy unto my people Israel.
Okay. I'll just ask for comments here before any other... I tried to get in too much perhaps at the end here to get set the stage. What Amos doing here? The King James translates it, I was no prophet. The RSV I think is a little better, although it's disputed, I am no prophet. I'm not a professional. By the way, he was well off. He says, I'm a livestock breeder, and I don't think you have to make, some people do it that, they make him very poor, you see that. But no, he's got flocks, you see that? And that would be what? Sheep and goats and cattle. That means, a certain amount of wealth there. He doesn't have to depend upon this for his livelihood. Where does that remind you of another biblical person who didn't depend upon his preaching for his livelihood?
I mean, Paul.
Paul? Mm-hmm. Remember when he'd say to the Corinthians, I wouldn't take a red cent from you. The only people I ever take any money from are the Philippians, and that's because they're poor. And because they don't want to give it to me, and then I have a little more free time for preaching the gospel. Otherwise, he carries his own weight, isn't it? I got the gospel freely, and I want to give it freely. And Amos is something like that here. He's not a professional. So I think the translation is a little better, I am not. The Hebrew doesn't say it. I, and then there is no, we just supply the word. I, not a prophet. I, not a disciple of the prophet, the prophet's son. But I'm a herdsman, a dresser of sycamore trees. What that means is that he gets an additional amount of labor by picking apples in Wenatchee. in other words, what he does is he'll go down there, and what they do is, I guess, take a nail and take, before it gets ripe, the fruit is, and if you touch it with a nail, when it ripens it gets sweet, otherwise it's sour. And so you do that. And that only grows in lower, at lower altitude, down near the Dead Sea or near the coast, and for that reason he must have traveled around. And he's, by the way, he's no dummy. He knows all of the wisdom of his people and so forth, but he is not interested in that. He's not a professional of any sort. But the big point here is that the Lord. Isn't that? The Lord took me from following the flock. And the Lord said, prophesy to my people Israel. You can also translate this, against my people Israel. Oh, I think that's a better translation. In other words, I'm not doing this to make a living. I just get into trouble by doing this. All the prophets got into trouble, especially as we'll see Jeremiah gets into trouble. But I must. So where is authority according to Amos? Where was the authority according to Amaziah?
King.
King, yeah. And I suppose his own sanctuary work, you see that? After all, he was a clock watcher, a deadbeat. He's doing what happened. But it wasn't working. The system wasn't working. Ordinarily, they should have been inculcating the covenant and all of its stipulations, the priests. But they weren't. So this is a very good example. And now he simply cuts through all of this and simply says, it's not that matter. It's a matter here. You can't compromise that. Some people think, and this may be true, that Amaziah is, he doesn't know what to do. And he's got just, until the messenger gets by, he has enough time, you see that. He doesn't really want to give all authority to the king. He doesn't really want to give all authority to the charismatic prophet, because he doesn't want to make up his mind. But it's quite clear that Amos has made up his mind. And so now comes a doom oracle. Now this gets really, this is the climax of the whole thing. Would you mind reading right there? It's Karen, I think, isn't it? 16 and 17.
You still listen to the word of Yahweh. You say, do not prophet against Israel. Utter no oracles against the house of Isaac. Very well, this is what Yahweh says. Your wife will be forced to go onto the street. Your sons and daughters will fall by the sword. Your land be parceled out by measuring lines. And you yourself die on unclean soil. And Israel will go into exile far distant from its own land.
Okay, just a few questions. This is a doom oracle or a judgment oracle. What's the guilt? You're refusing to hear the word of the Lord. All right. And saying, in effect, when he told him not to prophesy in this territory, but to go to the next territory, that he was kind of stopping Amos' mouth. And don't preach. There the translation is very good. Do not preach against the house of Israel.
Yeah.
Saying this is what? Conspiracy. So even though he hasn't heard, at least as far as we know, directly what the message was that was sent to the king, somehow Amos knows that. That what has really made this guy uptight is the fact that he has been against the government, against the people, against the authority of both the king and of the priests. And now then comes what we call the messenger formula, thus says the Lord. And which one of these judgments would you consider the worst? They're all bad. And they're to an individual. What would happen to an individual when their land was conquered? You think the exile would be the worst, to live in Siberia? Okay, the family is struck first, isn't it? The wife. And the only way she then survives is what? Becoming a whore. The sons are killed. How about the land? We've been talking about that, haven't we? What's going to happen to the land, the Lord's land?
Be divided up.
Divided up into, well, subdivisions, isn't it? And who will take it over? The Assyrians and the pro-Assyrian stooges that go along, the Quislings that go along with the Assyrians. And you will die where? Foreign land. And means the end of the kingdom. Now, whoever reported this oracle, it must have been one of the disciples of Amos. It's autobiographical. I mean, it's not autobiographical, it's biographical. Must have had a lot of more information about it. Many times we have nothing but just the doom oracle, verses 16 and 17. But he knew the whole story. And so he's telling us enough of the story. We'd like to know, what did the king do, wouldn't we? And you can spin it out. What do you think the king did? Maybe I shouldn't ask the question. But I think it's quite clear from the story, at least the probability is quite clear. No, he must have set out an edict for his head. You can't let that conspiracy go, because it'll mean your head if you don't get his head. But meanwhile, that's really not important as far as the prophets here. Enough has been said. A word to the wise is sufficient. Walker.
I just wanted to ask two questions. One is, the implication here seems to be that if Israel cleans up its act, if they get rid of the injustice, there won't be the invasion and the exile. That's the implication. But weren't the circumstances in the ancient world such that justice in Israel wasn't going to influence Syria's foreign policy or Egypt's foreign policy? And even if they did clean up their internal act, they might still be a prey to these powers.
Oh, that's very helpful.
And the mm-hmm. second one, too, mm-hmm. let me stop them both.
Sure, okay, good.
The second one is, after I've listened to you now for this morning, it seems to me that our modern prophet would be Albert Jarvis.
Would you explain that to me and everyone else?
Proposition 13, California, land reform, tax reform, and I'm not sure that I want to call Albert Jarvis the great prophet of 1978.
All right, I don't know much about him, but in the last part, I'm willing to discuss it. But the first part I think is really important. You said that if they clean up their act, the judgment will not come. I think that's quite clear throughout Amos. It may be, Amos says, perhaps it may be that the Lord will not do it. Let me just give you an example. Chapter 5, verse 14, seek good and evil that you may live. So the Lord your God of hosts will be with you, as you have said. Hate evil and love good. Establish justice in the gate. It may be that the Lord, the God of hosts, will be gracious to the remnant of Israel. You see that? A prophet, remember I said that yesterday, was not first of all a judgment sayer. He was first of all an intercessor. And when he was called in the first two visions, the first thing Amos did, he saw grasshoppers. That's what the Lord showed him. It was a plague. First thing he did is prayed for the people, almost like Naboth did. When in the time of a grasshopper plague or something like that. He said, O Lord, have mercy, how can Jacob stand? He is so small. And the answer came from the Lord, that's in chapter 7, verse 3, it shall not be. And somehow the grasshoppers were taken away. Then the second thing that Amos did also was, when there was a drought, a burning, he prayed the same way. O Lord God, cease, I beseech thee. How can Jacob stand? He is so small. The Lord repented concerning this, and he said, it shall not be. So they've had rain. Do you see that? When we came to the plumb line vision, then the Lord said, I don't want you to get down on your knees this time, Amos. I mean business. I'll no longer pass by. This is enough is enough. This is the end. You see, like at the time of the flood, it's Kate. It's the end. The autumn is here, and the winter is going to be. And the last of the five visions that comes here is where the Lord, he hisses like when you stick a dog on someone. And who is he asking? He's asking for the Assyrians, the Tiglath-Pileser, to come. Now the big question is, Amos is not just a shrewd person. Your first part of your question implied that he has logically mapped out the political situation and said, now, if we repent somehow, we can change this. No, he has to do this simply because he's been in the council of God, and God has called him to do it. You see that? It's not as if he is just a shrewd political scientist. He may be wise, and I think in general the prophets had a wiser political science policy than the kings. But it's not that. So, in a way, FDR once said in a press conference when the reporters ask him, if, he said, I don't answer iffy questions. And he loftily went out. So I don't know what would have happened. But I think one thing is clear, that a prophet originally tried to turn the people around. So that part of your question is right. And you know, at the end, when the prophets are all done, and none of them get anywhere, they all renounce against a stone wall. There's no reform movement here. You see that? No, never get anywhere. Then the prophet in exile says, Isaiah 43, it wasn't unto me that you guys offered all these sacrifices and brought all these burnt offerings, but you made me to serve with your sins. And they've heaped up, they didn't take care of their guilt, you see that? They broke the covenant and broke covenant. Now it's such a great heap. And then it finally comes out in that impassioned part where he says, even I will serve. And then you have the servant of the Lord coming out. And that's a different way of handling guilt. And that's by forgiveness. But that, at the end of the whole history of prophecy, where this ordinary thing didn't work out. Get the idea? And I guess that would take care of at least part of what you're saying. Jarvis, is that the man that says, I'm madder than hell? We're madder than hell. That's the man. Yeah, I don't know too much about that. Except that I saw in the New York Times, the Sunday Times, it says that Washington responded and said, okay, that means that the local government is going to get, local governments are going to give up everything and the federal government is going to take over, isn't it? And do the things that must be done. And so, would you want to explain any more what you said about that last part at Jarvis?
Well, if what's at stake is some kind of reform, then the seemingly great reform movement right now is not so much exemplified, let's say, by quest for racial justice or international justice, but simply tax relief, or as these people would put it, tax justice. A lot of tax inequities can be pointed to. So, in one sense, then, if we are looking for the modern outsider who enters the realm of the politicians, it would be somebody like mm-hmm. Jarvis. Mm-hmm. I guess, in a way, I'm asking, how do you tell who's a prophet?
I think Jarvis John did it very well in the sermon Sunday evening when he quoted King, and quoted King on the gospel.
But we're 10 years past Martin Luther King. It's easy to look back at him mm-hmm. and to say, yes, there was a prophet, although while he was in the middle of it, mm-hmm. Sermons were preached against Martin Luther King in churches and everything else. I guess I'm asking, who in 1978 is the prophet?
Okay, that's a very good question.
Jarvis is one of the candidates.
I just have trouble with the idea that that's genuine reform, biblically understood. Well, because
so do I.
The biblical measure is, does it tend to transfer power and riches to the poor? And Jarvis, Proposition 13, and all that follows that moves the other way, it seems to me. So I guess I would question, it's called reform, of course. But at whose expense and for whose benefit would be the question. I don't think Proposition 13 is helping the poor to get more resources and services.
Just looking at the pictures in Time magazine, that's the impression I had. I haven't studied it, but just looking at the pictures of publicity, that's all I looked at. But I think we have to stop here. But that's all right. Why don't we stop with the problem? We haven't solved it.